Pushkin.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Co. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count for your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I once worked at a company that was trying to disrupt the news industry. It did not end well for the industry or for the company. But if you entered the workforce circa 2013, as I did, disruption was the word on everybody's lips. Around that time, Jill Lepore got an assignment at The New Yorker to dig a bit deeper into this earth-shaking theory. And what she found led her to write one of her most controversial essays, The Disruption Machine.
Like, the place where I worked was being changed. My favorite newspaper was being changed. I'm sure, you know, anything else I read was being affected. The publishing industry was being affected. Public education was being affected. Hospitals, like, it was everywhere. Like, disrupt or die. And so then I said to the editor, okay, I'm willing to write the piece.
Stick around afterwards for a conversation between me and Jill about how the essay's aged and the difference between being an old fogey and telling the truth. From the Disrupt or Die 2010s, here's The Disruption Machine.
The Disruption Machine. In the last years of the 1980s, I worked not at startups, but at what might be called finish downs. Tech companies that were dying would hire temps, college students, and new graduates to do what little was left to the work of the employees they'd laid off. This was in Cambridge, near MIT. I type user's manuals, save them onto a 5.25-inch floppy disk, and send them to a line printer that yammered like a set of prank shop chatter teeth. But by the time the last perforated page coiled out of it, the equipment whose functions those manuals explained had been discontinued. We'd work a month here, a week there. There wasn't much to do. Mainly, we sat at our desks and wrote wishy-washy poems on keyboards manufactured by Digital Equipment Corporation, left one another sly messages on pink while you were out sticky notes, swapped paperback novels, Kurt Vonnegut, Margaret Atwood, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, that kind of thing, and during lunch hour had assignations in empty unlocked offices. At Polaroid, I once found a Bantam Books edition of Steppenwolf in a clogged sink in an employee's bathroom, floating like a raft. In his heart, he was not a man, but a wolf of the steppes, it said on the bloated cover. The rest was unreadable. Not long after that, I got a better assignment, answering the phone for Michael Porter, a professor at Harvard Business School. I was an assistant to his assistant. In 1985, Porter had published a book called Competitive Advantage, in which he elaborated on three strategies, cost leadership, differentiation, and focus, that he described in his 1980 book, Competitive Strategy. I almost never saw Porter, and when I did, he was dashing affably out the door, suitcase in hand. My job was to field inquiries from companies that wanted to book him for speaking engagements. The Competitive Advantage of Nations appeared in 1990. Porter's ideas about business strategy reached executives all over the world. Porter was interested in how companies succeed. The scholar who in some respects became his successor, Clayton M. Christensen, entered a doctoral program at Harvard Business School in 1989 and joined the faculty in 1992. Christensen was interested in why companies fail. In his 1997 book, The Innovator's Dilemma, he argued that very often it isn't because their executives made bad decisions, but because they made good decisions, the same kind of good decisions that had made those companies successful for decades. The innovator's dilemma is that doing the right thing is the wrong thing. As Christensen saw it, the problem was the velocity of history, and it wasn't so much a problem as a missed opportunity, like a plane that takes off without you, except that you didn't even know there was a plane and had wandered onto the airfield, which you thought was a meadow, and the plane ran you over during takeoff. Manufacturers of mainframe computers made good decisions about making and selling mainframe computers and devising important refinements to them in their R&D departments. Sustaining innovations, Christensen called them. But busy pleasing their mainframe customers one tinker at a time, they missed what an entirely untapped customer wanted. Personal computers, the market for which was created by what Christensen called disruptive innovation. The selling of a cheaper, poorer quality product that initially reaches less profitable customers, but eventually takes over and devours an entire industry. Ever since the innovator's dilemma, everyone is either disrupting or being disrupted. There are disruption consultants, disruption conferences, and disruption seminars. In 2014, the University of Southern California is opening a new program. The degree is in disruption, the university announced. Disrupt or be disrupted, the venture capitalist Josh Linkner warns in a new book, The Road to Reinvention, in which he argues that fickle consumer trends, friction-free markets, and political unrest, along with dizzying speed, exponential complexity, and mind-numbing technology advances, mean that the time has come to panic as you've never panicked before. Larry Downes and Paul Nunes, who blog for Forbes, insist that we have entered a new and even scarier age, Big Bang disruption. This isn't disruptive innovation, they warn. It's devastating innovation. Things you own or use that are now considered to be the product of disruptive innovation include your smartphone and many of its apps, which have disrupted businesses from travel agencies and record stores to map making and taxi dispatch. Much more disruption, we are told, lies ahead. Christensen has co-written books urging disruptive innovation in higher education, The Innovative University, Public Schools, Disrupting Class, and Healthcare, The Innovator's Prescription. His acolytes and imitators, including no small number of hucksters, have called for the disruption of more or less everything else. If the company you work for has a chief innovation officer, it's because of the long arm of the innovator's dilemma. If your city's public school district has adopted an innovation agenda, which has disrupted the education of every kid in the city, you live in the shadow of the innovator's dilemma. If you saw an episode of the HBO sitcom Silicon Valley in which the characters attend a conference called TechCrunch Disrupt 2014, which is a real thing, and a guy from the stage, a Paul Rudd lookalike, shouts, "Let me hear it! Disrupt!" You have heard the voice of Clay Christensen echoing across the valley. In 2014, days after the Times publisher Arthur Sulzberger Jr. fired Jill Abramson, the paper's executive editor, the Times' innovation report was leaked. It included graphs inspired by Christensen's innovator's dilemma, along with a lengthy, glowing summary of the book's key arguments. The report explains, "Disruption is a predictable pattern across many industries in which fledgling companies use new technology to offer cheaper and inferior alternatives to products sold by established players. Think Toyota taking on Detroit decades ago. Today, a pack of new startups are hoping to disrupt our industry by attacking the strongest incumbent, the New York Times." A pack of attacking startups sounds something like a pack of ravenous hyena. But generally, the rhetoric of disruption, a language of panic, fear, asymmetry, and disorder, calls on the rhetoric of another kind of conflict, in which an upstart refuses to play by the established rules of engagement and blows things up. Don't think of Toyota taking on Detroit. Startups are ruthless and leaderless and unrestrained, and they seem so tiny and powerless until you realize, but only after it's too late, that they're devastatingly dangerous. Bang, kaboom. Think of it this way. The Times is a nation state. BuzzFeed is stateless. Disruptive innovation is competitive strategy for an age seized by terror. Every age has a theory of rising and falling, of growth and decay, of bloom and wilt, a theory of nature. Every age also has a theory about the past and the present, of what was and what is, a notion of time, a theory of history. Theories of history used to be supernatural. The divine ruled time, the hand of God, a special providence, lay behind the fall of each sparrow. If the present differed from the past, it was usually worse. Supernatural theories of history tend to involve decline, a fall from grace, the loss of God's favor, corruption. Beginning in the 18th century, as the intellectual historian Dorothy Ross once pointed out, theories of history became secular. Then they started something new, historicism, the idea that all events in historical time can be explained by prior events in historical time. Things began looking up. First there was that, then there was this, and this is better than that. The 18th century embraced the idea of progress. The 19th century had evolution. The 20th century had growth, and then innovation. Our era has disruption, which, despite its futurism, is atavistic. It's a theory of history founded on a profound anxiety about financial collapse, an apocalyptic fear of global devastation, and shaky evidence. Most big ideas have loud critics, not disruption. Disruptive innovation, as the explanation for how change happens, has been subject to little serious criticism, partly because it's headlong, while critical inquiry is unhurried, partly because disruptors ridicule doubters by charging them with fogyism, as if to criticize a theory of change were identical to decrying change, and partly because, in its modern usage, innovation is the idea of progress jammed into a criticism-proof jack-in-the-box. The idea of progress, the notion that human history is the history of human betterment, dominated the worldview of the West between the Enlightenment and the First World War. It had critics from the start, and in the last century, even people who cherished the idea of progress and point to improvements like the eradication of contagious diseases and the education of girls have been hard-pressed to hold on to it while reckoning with two world wars, the Holocaust and Hiroshima, genocide, and global warming. Replacing progress with innovation skirts the question of whether a novelty is an improvement. The world may not be getting better and better, but our devices are getting newer and newer. The word innovate, to make new, used to have chiefly negative connotations. It signified excessive novelty without purpose or end. Edmund Burke called the French Revolution a revolt of innovation. Federalists declared themselves to be enemies to innovation. George Washington, on his deathbed, was said to have uttered these words, "Beware of innovation in politics." Noah Webster warned in his dictionary in 1828, "It is often dangerous to innovate on the customs of a nation." The redemption of innovation began in 1939, when the economist Joseph Schumpeter, in his landmark study of business cycles, used the word to mean bringing new products to market. A usage that spread slowly and only in the specialized literatures of economics and business. In 1942, Schumpeter theorized about creative destruction. Christensen, retrofitting, believes that Schumpeter was really describing the disruptive innovation. Innovation began to seep beyond specialized literatures in the 1990s and gained ubiquity only after 9/11. One measure? Between 2011 and 2014, Time, The Times Magazine, The New Yorker, Forbes, and even Better Homes and Gardens published a special innovation issue, the modern equivalents of what, a century ago, were known as sketches of men of progress. The idea of innovation is the idea of progress stripped of the aspirations of the Enlightenment, scrubbed clean of the horrors of the 20th century, and relieved of its critics. Disruptive innovation goes further, holding out the hope of salvation against the very damnation it describes. Disrupt, and you will be saved. Disruptive innovation as a theory of change is meant to serve both as a chronicle of the past, this has happened, and as a model for the future, it will keep happening. The strength of a prediction made from a model depends on the quality of the historical evidence and on the reliability of the methods used to gather and interpret it. Historical analysis proceeds from certain conditions regarding proof. None of these conditions have been met. The Innovator's Dilemma consists of a set of hand-picked case studies, beginning with the disk drive industry, which was the subject of Christensen's doctoral thesis in 1992. Nowhere in the history of business has there been an industry like disk drives, Christensen writes, which makes it a very odd choice for an investigation designed to create a model for understanding other industries. The first hard disk drive, which weighed more than a ton, was invented at IBM in 1955 by a team that included Alan Shugart. Christensen is chiefly concerned with an era beginning in the late 1970s when disk drives decreased in size from 14 inches to 8, then from 8 to 5 1/4, from 5 1/4 to 3 1/2, from 3 1/2 to 2 1/2, and to 1.8. He counts 116 new technologies and classes 111 of them as sustaining innovations and 5 as disruptive innovations. Each of these 5, he says, introduced smaller disk drives that were slower and had lower capacity than those used in the mainstream market. And each company that adopted them was an entrance firm that toppled an established firm. In 1973, Alan Shugart founded Shugart Associates, which introduced a 5 1/4-inch floppy disk drive in 1976. The company was bought by Xerox the next year. In 1978, Shugart Associates developed an 8-inch hard disk drive. Christensen, who is uninterested in the floppy disk industry, classes the company as an entrant firm and credits it with disrupting established firms that manufactured 14-inch hard drives. In 1979, Alan Shugart founded Shugart Technology, which changed its name to Seagate Technology after Xerox threatened to sue. In 1980, Seagate Technology introduced the first 5 1/4-inch hard disk drive. Christensen at this point classes Seagate as an entrant firm and Shugart Associates as a failed incumbent, even though Shugart Associates was shifting its focus to what was then its very profitable floppy drive business. In the mid-80s, Seagate, here considered by Christensen to be an established firm, delayed manufacturing 3 1/2-inch drives, which were valued by producers of portable computers and laptops, because its biggest customer, IBM, didn't want them. IBM wanted a better and faster version of the 5 1/4-inch drive for its full-size desktop computers. Seagate didn't start shipping 3 1/2-inch drives until 1988, and by then, Christensen argues, it was too late. In his original research, Christensen established the cutoff for measuring a company's success or failure as 1989 and explained that successful firms were arbitrarily defined as those which achieved more than $50 million in revenues in constant 1987 dollars in any single year between 1977 and 1989, even if they subsequently withdrew from the market. Much of the theory of disruptive innovation rests on this arbitrary definition of success. In fact, Seagate Technology was not felled by disruption. Between 1989 and 1990, its sales doubled, reaching $2.4 billion, more than all of its U.S. competitors combined, according to an industry report. In 1997, the year Christensen published The Innovator's Dilemma, Seagate was the largest company in the disk drive industry, reporting revenues of $9 billion. In 2013, Seagate shipped its 2 billionth disk drive. Most of the entrant firms celebrated by Christensen as triumphant disruptors, on the other hand, no longer exist, their success having been in some cases brief and in others illusory. The fleeting nature of their success is, of course, perfectly consistent with his model. Between 1982 and 1984, Micropolis made the disruptive leap from 8-inch to 5 1/4-inch disk drives through what Christensen credits as the Herculean managerial effort of its CEO, Stuart Mahan. Mahan remembers the experience as the most exhausting of his life, Christensen writes. But shortly thereafter, Micropolis, unable to compete with companies like Seagate, failed. Miniscribe, founded in 1980, started out selling 5 1/4-inch drives and saw a quick success. That was Miniscribe's hour of glory, the company's founder later said. We had 1 hour of infamy shortly after that. In 1989, Miniscribe was investigated for fraud and soon collapsed. A report charged that the company's practices included fabricated financial reports and shipping bricks and scrap parts disguised as disk drives. As striking as the disruption in the disk drive industry seemed in the 1980s, more striking from the vantage of history are the continuities. Christensen argues that incumbents in the disk drive industry were regularly destroyed by newcomers. But today, after much consolidation, the divisions that dominate the industry are divisions that led the market in the 1980s. In some instances, what has shifted was their ownership. IBM sold its hard disk division to Hitachi, which later sold its division to Western Digital. In the longer term, victory in the disk drive industry appears to have gone to the manufacturers that were good at incremental improvements, whether or not they were the first to market the disruptive new format. Companies that were quick to release a new product but not skilled at tinkering have tended to flame out. Other cases in the innovator's dilemma are equally murky. In his account of the mechanical excavator industry, Christensen argues that established companies that built cable-operated excavators were slow to recognize the importance of the hydraulic excavator, which was developed in the late 1940s. Almost the entire population of mechanical shovel manufacturers was wiped out by a disruptive technology, hydraulics, that the leaders' customers and their economic structure had caused them initially to ignore, he argues. Christensen counts 30 established companies in the 1950s and says that by the 1970s, only four had survived the entrance into the industry of 13 disruptive newcomers, including Caterpillar, O&K, Demag, and Hitachi. But in fact, many of Christensen's new entrants had been making cable-operated shovels for years. O&K, founded in 1876, had been making them since 1908. Demag had been building excavators since 1925, when it bought a company that built steam shovels. Hitachi, founded in 1910, sold cable-operated shovels before the Second World War. Manufacturers that were genuinely new to excavation equipment tended to sell a lot of hydraulic excavators if they had a strong distribution network, and then not do so well. And some established companies disrupted by hydraulics didn't do half as badly as Christensen suggests. Bucyrus, the old line shovel maker he writes about the most, got its start in Ohio in 1880, built most of the excavators that dug the Panama Canal, and became Bucyrus Erie in 1927 when it bought the Erie Steam Shovel Company. It acquired a hydraulics equipment firm in 1948, but, Christensen writes, faced precisely the same problems in marketing its hydraulic backhoe as Seagate had faced with its 3.5-inch drives. Unable to persuade its established customers to buy a hydraulic excavator, Bucyrus introduced a hybrid product called the HydraHoe in 1951, a merely sustaining innovation. Christensen says that Bucyrus logged record profits until 1966, the point at which the disruptive hydraulics technology had squarely intersected with customers' needs, and then began to decline. This is typical of industries facing a disruptive technology, he explains. The leading firm in the established technology remains financially strong until the disruptive technology is, in fact, in the midst of their mainstream market. But actually, between 1962 and 1979, Bucyrus's sales grew sevenfold, and its profits grew 25-fold. Was that so bad? In the 1980s, Bucyrus suffered. The whole construction industry did. It was devastated by recession, inflation, the oil crisis, a drop in home building, and the slowing of highway construction. Caterpillar sustained heavy losses, too. In the early 1990s, after a disastrous leveraged buyout handled by Goldman Sachs, Bucyrus entered Chapter 11 protection, but it made some sizable acquisitions when it emerged as Bucyrus International and was a leading maker of mining equipment, just as it had been a century earlier. Was it a failure? Caterpillar didn't think so when, in 2011, it bought the firm for nearly $9 billion. Christensen's sources are often dubious and his logic questionable. His single citation for his investigation of the disruptive transition from mechanical to electronic motor controls, in which he identifies the Allen Bradley Company as triumphing over four rivals, is a book called The Bradley Legacy, an account published by a foundation established by the company's founders. This is akin to calling an actor the greatest talent in a generation after interviewing his publicist. Use theory to help guide data collection, Christensen advises. He finds further evidence of his theory in the disruption of the department store by the discount store. Just as in disk drives and excavators, he writes, a few of the leading traditional retailers, notably S.S. Kresge, F.W. Woolworth, and Dayton Hudson, saw the disruptive approach coming and invested early. In 1962, Kresge, which traces its origins to 1897, opened Kmart. Dayton Hudson, 1902, opened Target, and Woolworth, 1879, opened Woolco. Kresge and Dayton Hudson ran their discount stores as independent organizations. Woolworth ran its discount store in-house. Kmart and Target succeeded. Woolco failed. Christensen presents the story as yet more evidence of an axiom derived from the disk drive industry. Two models for how to make money cannot peacefully coexist within a single organization. In the mid-1990s, Kmart closed more than 200 stores, a fact that Christensen does not include in his account of the industry's history. Kmart filed for bankruptcy in 2002. Only in a footnote does he make a vague allusion to Kmart's troubles. When this book was being written, Kmart was a crippled company. And then he dismisses this piece of counter-evidence by fiat. Kmart's present competitive struggles are unrelated to Kresge's strategy in meeting the original disruptive threat of discounting. In his discussion of the steel industry, in which he argues that established companies were disrupted by the technology of mini-milling, melting down scrap metal to make cheaper, lower-quality sheet metal, Christensen writes that U.S. Steel, founded in 1901, lowered the cost of steel production from 9 labor hours per ton of steel produced in 1980 to just under 3 hours per ton in 1991, which he attributes to the company's ferociously attacking the size of its workforce, paring it from more than 93,000 in 1980 to fewer than 23,000 in 1991, in order to point out that even this accomplishment could not stop the coming disruption. Christensen tends to ignore factors that don't support his theory. Factors having effects on both production and profitability that Christensen does not mention are that between 1986 and 1987, 22,000 workers at U.S. Steel did not go to work as part of a labor action, and that U.S. Steel's workers are unionized and have been for generations, while many mill manufacturers with their newer workforces are generally non-union. Christensen's logic here seems to be that the industry's labor arrangements can have played no role in U.S. Steel's struggles and are not even worth mentioning because U.S. Steel's struggles must be a function of its having failed to build mini mills. U.S. Steel's struggles have been and remain grave, but its failure is by no means a matter of historical record. Today, the largest U.S. producer of steel is U.S. Steel. The theory of disruption is meant to be predictive. On March 10, 2000, Christensen launched a $3.8 million disruptive growth fund, which he managed with Neil Eisner, a broker in St. Louis. Christensen drew on his theory to select stocks. Less than a year later, the fund was quietly liquidated. During a stretch of time when the NASDAQ lost 50% of its value, the disruptive growth fund lost 65%. In 2007, Christensen told Business Week that the prediction of the theory would be that Apple won't succeed with the iPhone, adding, "History speaks pretty loudly on that." In its first 5 years, the iPhone generated $150 billion of revenue. In the preface to the 2011 edition of The Innovator's Dilemma, Christensen reports that since the book's publication in 1997, the theory of disruptive innovation continues to yield predictions that are quite accurate. This is less because people have used his model to make accurate predictions about things that haven't happened yet than because disruption has been sold as advice and because much that has happened between 1997 and 2011 looks, in retrospect, disruptive. Disruptive innovation can reliably be seen only after the fact. History speaks loudly, apparently, only when you can make it say what you want it to say. The popular incarnation of the theory tends to disavow history altogether. Predicting the future based on the past is like betting on a football team simply because it won the Super Bowl a decade ago, Joss Linkler writes in The Road to Reinvention. His first principle, let go of the past. It has nothing to tell you. But unless you already believe in disruption, many of the successes that have been labeled disruptive innovation look like something else. And many of the failures that are often seen to have resulted from failing to embrace disruptive innovation look like bad management. Christensen has compared the theory of disruptive innovation to a theory of nature, the theory of evolution. But among the many differences between disruption and evolution is that the advocates of disruption have an affinity for circular arguments. If an established company doesn't disrupt, it will fail. And if it fails, it must be because it didn't disrupt. When a startup fails, that's a success, since epidemic failure is a hallmark of disruptive innovation. Stop being afraid of failure and start embracing it, the organizers of FailCon, an annual conference, implore, suggesting that in an era of disruption, innovators face unprecedented challenges. For instance, maybe you made the wrong hires. When an established company succeeds, that's only because it hasn't yet failed. And when any of these things happen, all of them are only further evidence of disruption. The hand-picked case study, which is Christensen's method, is a notoriously weak foundation on which to build a theory. But if the hand-picked case study is the approved approach, it would seem that efforts at embracing disruptive innovation are often fatal. Morrison Knudsen, an engineering and construction firm, got its start in 1905 and helped build more than 150 dams all over the world, including the Hoover. Beginning in 1988, a new CEO, William Agee, looked to new products and new markets, and after Bill Clinton's election in 1992, bet on mass transit, turning to the construction of both commuter and long-distance train cars through two subsidiaries, MK Transit and MK Rail. These disruptive businesses proved to be a disaster. Morrison Knudsen announced in 1995 that it had lost $350 million, by which point the company had essentially collapsed, not because it didn't disruptively innovate, but because it did. Time Inc., founded in 1922, auto-disrupted too. In 1994, the company launched Pathfinder, an early new media venture, an umbrella website for its magazines, at a cost estimated to have exceeded $100 million. The site was abandoned in 1999. Had Pathfinder been successful, it would have been greeted retrospectively as evidence of disruptive innovation. Instead, as one of its producers put it, it's like it never existed. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, the financial services industry innovated by selling products like subprime mortgages, collateralized debt obligations, and mortgage-backed securities, some to a previously untapped customer base. At the time, Ed Clark was the CEO of Canada's TD Bank, which traces its roots to 1855. Clark, who earned a PhD in economics at Harvard with a dissertation on public investment in Tanzania, forswore Canada's version of this disruptive innovation, asset-backed commercial paper. The decision made TD Bank one of the strongest banks in the world. Between 2002 and 2012, TD Bank's assets increased from $278 billion to $806 billion. Since 2005, TD Bank has opened 1,300 branches in the United States, bought Commerce Bank for $8.5 billion in 2008, and adopted the motto, America's Most Convenient Bank. With the money it earned by expanding its traditional banking services, almost $4 billion a year during the height of the financial crisis, according to the Canadian business reporter Howard Green, it set about marketing itself as the bank with the longest hours, the best teller services, and free dog biscuits. When the financial services industry disruptively innovated, it led to a global financial crisis. Like the bursting of the dot-com bubble, the meltdown didn't dim the fervor for disruption. Instead, it fueled it, because these products of disruptive innovation contributed to the panic on which the theory of disruption thrives. Disruptive innovation as an explanation for how change happens is everywhere. Ideas that come from business schools are exceptionally well marketed. Faith in disruption is the best illustration and the worst case of a larger historical transformation having to do with secularization and what happens when the invisible hand replaces the hand of God as explanation and justification. Innovation and disruption are ideas that originated in the arena of business, but which have since been applied to arenas whose values and goals are remote from the values and goals of business. People aren't disk drives. Public schools, colleges and universities, churches, museums, many hospitals, all of which have been subjected to disruptive innovation, have revenues and expenses and infrastructures, but they aren't industries in the same way that manufacturers of hard disk drives or truck engines or dry goods are industries. Journalism isn't an industry in that sense either. Doctors have obligation to their patients, teachers to their students, pastors to their congregations, curators to the public, and journalists to their readers, obligations that lie outside the realm of earnings and are fundamentally different from the obligations that a business executive has to employees, partners, and investors. Historically, institutions like museums, hospitals, schools, and universities have been supported by patronage, donations made by individuals, or funding from church or state. The press has generally supported itself by charging subscribers and selling advertising. Underwriting by corporations and foundations is a funding source of more recent vintage. Charging for admission, membership, subscriptions, and for some, earning profits are similarities these institutions have with businesses. Still, that doesn't make them industries, which turn things into commodities and sell them for gain. In The Innovative University, written with Henry J. Ehring, who used to work at the Monitor Group, a consulting firm co-founded by Michael Porter, Christensen subjected Harvard, a college founded by 17th-century theocrats, to his case study analysis. Studying the university's history, Christensen and Ehring wrote, will allow us to move beyond the forlorn language of crisis to hopeful and practical strategies for success. On the basis of this research, Christensen and Ehring's recommendations for the disruption of the modern university include a mix of face-to-face and online learning. The publication of The Innovative University in 2011 contributed to a frenzy for massive open online courses, or MOOCs, at colleges and universities across the country, including a collaboration between Harvard and MIT, which was announced in May of 2012. Shortly afterward, the University of Virginia's panicked Board of Trustees attempted to fire the president, charging her with jeopardizing the institution's future by failing to disruptively innovate with sufficient speed. The vice chair of the board forwarded to the chair a Times column written by David Brooks, The Campus Tsunami, in which he cited Christensen. Christensen and Ehring's recommendations of a mix of face-to-face and online learning was drawn from an investigation that involves a wildly misguided attempt to apply standards of instruction in the 21st century to standards of instruction in the 17th. In 2014, there were 21,000 students at Harvard. In 1640, there were 13. The first year classes were held, Harvard students and their non-specialized faculty, one young schoolmaster, Nathaniel Eaton, enjoying small face-to-face classes, Eaton's wife, who fed the students, was accused of putting goat's dung in their hasty pudding. With high faculty empathy for learners, Eaton conducted thrashings with a stick of walnut said to have been big enough to have killed a horse. Could have paddled together in a single canoe. That doesn't mean good arguments can't be made for online education, but there's nothing factually persuasive in this account of its historical urgency and even inevitability, which relies on a method well outside anything resembling plausible historical analysis. Christensen and Ehring also urge universities to establish heavyweight innovation teams. Christensen thinks that R&D departments housed within a business and accountable to its executives are structurally unable to innovate disruptively. They're preoccupied with pleasing existing customers through incremental improvement. Christensen argues, for instance, that if Digital Equipment Corporation, which was doing very well making mini computers in the 1960s and 70s, had founded in the 80s a separate company at another location to develop the personal computer, it might have triumphed. The logic of disruptive innovation is the logic of the startup. Establish a team of innovators, set a whiteboard under a blue sky, and never ask them to make a profit, because there needs to be a wall of separation between the people whose job is to come up with the best, smartest, and most creative and important ideas, and the people whose job is to make money by selling stuff. Interestingly, a similar principle has existed for more than a century in the press. The heavyweight innovation team? That's what journalists used to call the newsroom. It's readily apparent that in a democracy, the important business interests of institutions like the press might at times conflict with what became known as the public interest. That's why, a very long time ago, newspapers like The Times and magazines like The New Yorker established a wall of separation between the editorial side of affairs and the business side. The metaphor is to the Jeffersonian wall between church and state. The wall dividing the newsroom and business side has served The Times well for decades, according to The Times' 2014 Innovation Report, allowing one side to focus on readers and the other to focus on advertisers, as if this had been, all along, simply a matter of office efficiency. But the notion of a wall should be abandoned, according to the report, because it has hidden costs that thwart innovation. Shortly before the release of the report, The Times tried to recruit, as its new head of audience development, Michael Wertheim, the former head of promotion at the disruptive media outfit Upworthy. Wertheim turned The Times job down, citing its wall as too big an obstacle to disruptive innovation. The recommendation of the innovation report is to understand that both sides, editorial and business, share as their top priority reader experience, which can be measured, following Upworthy, in attention minutes. Vox Media, a digital media disruptor that is mentioned 10 times in the Times report and is included, along with BuzzFeed, in a list of the Times' strongest competitors, few of which are profitable, called the report brilliant, shockingly good, and an insanely clear explanation of disruption, but expressed the view that there's no way the Times will implement its recommendations because what the report doesn't mention is the sobering conclusion of Christensen's research. Companies faced with disruptive threats almost never manage to handle them gracefully. Disruptive innovation is a theory about why businesses fail. It's not more than that. It doesn't explain change. It's not a law of nature. It's an artifact of history, an idea forged in time. It's the manufacture of a moment of upsetting and edgy uncertainty. Transfixed by change, it's blind to continuity. It makes a very poor profit. The upstarts who work at startups don't often stay at any one place for very long. 3 out of 4 startups fail. More than 9 out of 10 never earn a return. They work a year here, a few months there. Zany hours everywhere. They wear jeans and sneakers and ride scooters and share offices and sprawl on couches like Great Danes. Their coffee machines look like dollhouse-sized factories. They are told that they should be reckless and ruthless. Their investors, if they're like Josh Linkner, tell them that the world is a terrifying place, moving at a devastating pace. Today I run a venture capital firm and back the next generation of innovators who are, as I was throughout my early career, dead focused on eating your lunch, Linkner writes. His job appears to be to convince a generation of people who want to do good and do well to learn instead remorselessness. Forget rules, obligations, your conscience, loyalty, a sense of the common weal. If you start a business and it succeeds, Linkner advises, sell it and take the cash. Don't look back. Never pause. Disrupt or be disrupted. But they do pause, and they do look back, and they wonder. Meanwhile, they tweet, they post, they tumble in and out of love, they ponder. They send one another sly messages, touching the screens of sleek, soundless machines with a worshipful tenderness. They swap novels, David Foster Wallace, Zadie Smith. Steppenwolf is still available in print, $5 cheaper as an ebook. He's a wolf, he's a man. The rest is unreadable. So, as ever, is the future. 2014.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, NA member FDIC, copyright 2024. JPMorgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
So the disruption machine.
Hmm.
Something that I really loved this essay, and I remember reading it when I was working at a startup that was
disruptively innovating.
That was disruptively innovating the
news industry.
Yeah. And I felt so crazy the whole time that I was there. And it was the kind of what's real, what's not, is the whole world sort of just trying to disrupt everything that I believe in. And this essay really takes down that idea of disruption, that it's a creative act, that it's a generative act or a good thing. But you write about being accused of fogyism, risking coming across as an old fogey, which is, it's so easy to paint people that way when they criticize modern movements. And I'm wondering how you avoid falling into an old fogey trap while still maintaining a healthy skepticism about these things.
I'm not sure I did. I mean, I wasn't an old fogey then, but I'm more of an old fogey now. This is an old essay. Maybe it's the oldest one in the collection. There is actually way more now sort of self-proclaimed Luddism. Like, you see people your age all the time talking about, like, let's take back the banner of Luddism. There's like a new book about it. We're in a very different moment now. But at that time, one of the things that was so concerning about disruptive innovation as an ideology, it really was just an ideology, it's not even really a theory, was that it had been designed to be, in a very self-conscious way, immune to criticism, because like your criticism could just be folded into it. So yeah, I will say I was really reluctant to write this essay because it involved writing about the work of, in the notional sense, a colleague of mine. I mean, Clayton Christensen, the coiner of disruptive innovation, the real proponent of its ideas, its most celebrated guru. It was at the Harvard Business School at the time. He's since died. And I, you know, it was going to require taking down a whole person's life work. So I was very reluctant to do it. And when I was first asked if I would write about it, I went and read the first of Christensen's book, which I think was published in 1998, The Innovator's Dilemma, which had been his dissertation. He had been a Harvard Business School student when he wrote the dissertation about the disk drive industry. And I remember writing to my editor and saying, like, why would I write about this? This is like, nobody can believe this. Like, this is just like so patently wrong. Like, it's, this is nothing. Like, I've never even heard of it. Like, I kind of had not descended on me. Like, you're working at a disruptive startup, but I don't know. I was teaching history. Like I was completely, not completely, I was fairly immune to the world of people being very excited about disruption. And then after I had read the book, the Times Innovation Report, which was a sort of self-appointed kind of committee report about how the Times should and whether it should disruptively innovate, came out. It was leaked. And then Jill Abramson, who had been executive editor, was fired, and kind of became clear that she had objected to the changes that were proposed in the innovation report. And then I love the New York Times and really care about it. And the innovation report was, whoever put it together just swallowed whole the ideas from the innovator's dilemma and had included these, you know, charts that, you know, show the like growth of like BuzzFeed as against the, you know, the sort of the duel between sustaining innovation and its inevitable failure and obsolescence and the excitement of disruptive innovation. And I thought the report was alarmingly idiotic, and it proposed to remake the New York Times in the mode of BuzzFeed. I would be the first to say I know nothing about how the news industry needed to deal with the acceleration of technological change and the obsolescence of the business model of, you know, classifieds and big advertising and subscription that the newspaper industry was built on. Like, I don't mean to suggest I know what newspapers should have done, and certainly there's huge changes necessary. But it would not seem like a wise thing to model your change after an ideology that's based on really, really shaky empirical work. And it really, really bugged me. And then it was that same semester, Harvard announced that it had made a deal with MIT in this organization, a company called edX, to do massive online camp classes or whatever, or MOOCs, and that this was going to be the disruptive innovation thing for higher education. And Christensen had written a book about this, and my kids' public school district, the superintendent had read Christensen's book about disrupting schools and decided that the entire school district needed to be restructured around the disruptive innovation that was called for by Christensen in the book about education. And so suddenly this thing that I was like, no one could possibly take this idea seriously, was like everywhere in my life. Like the place where I worked was being changed. My favorite newspaper was being changed. I'm sure, you know, anything else I read was being affected. The publishing industry was being affected. Public education was being affected. Hospitals, like it was everywhere. Like disrupt or die. And so then I said to the editor, okay, like, I'm willing to write the piece.
How long did you sit on the idea before writing it?
It was several months. Mm. I really was pretty reluctant, honestly, to do it. I don't think I've ever written a takedown before or since. And I was right to be nervous about it. It elicited this really crazy, crazy reaction. But, you know, I remember biking over to the historical collections at the Baker Business Library, the Harvard Business School, and reading his dissertation, going back through the archival records of the companies that he described as disruptively innovating or failing to disruptively innovate, and picking these, you know, looking at these various case studies. I put a lot of time into basically, you know, redoing. And also because the original book had been published in 1998 and I was writing in, I don't know, 2013 or something, you could see did the predictions that he made for these industries carry out. And, you know, like the predictions that most political commentators make, like, no, they didn't, most of them, or at least more than half of them. Like, there was no... He had also started an investment company that had failed to make any money. Like, it turned out not to be predictive at all. And the whole idea behind the model was that it was a predictive model. So it didn't even really describe the past well, but you would have to have a lot of historical evidence in order to make a model to build on the data that you have, the historical data, to make a model that could be predictive. And the historical evidence just didn't even support any consistent interpretation, certainly not the one that he offered. So, yeah, so I don't think I would ever have written the piece if the innovation report of the New York Times hadn't come out. It was really shocking to me. That's people who were that smart and cared so much about what they were doing and understood its importance to the public. However, you know, urgently they had to understand there needed to be a tremendous amount of change in how they did what they did, would just import wholesale, like this just wildly flawed set of ideas about how change happens.
Yeah. I have one last question about this, which is you frame the piece with a personal story. You talk about the temp agency in the first paragraph and your work as a assistant for, like an executive assistant for Michael Porter. Why did you settle on a personal frame for this story that was so current and was so much about diagnosing a particular moment and a particular pathology that came from a person who, while it was Porter's successor in some ways, you know, was not the character you began with.
Yeah. It's funny. It had a kind of weird consequence, which was that, I don't think I've ever said this in, on the record anywhere, but when the piece came out, Christensen called me in and he came to my office multiple times and left me notes and he called me and he wanted to meet and he wanted to meet and he wanted to make a pledge with me. Well, he wanted me to retract the piece, but then he wanted to make a pledge with me. He wanted me to promise that we would neither of us speak to the press about the piece. He didn't want to like wage some proxy battle in the press. And I was like, that's fine. I'm not going to speak to the press about the piece. I never do that. And then he immediately spoke to the press and described me as a criminal liar to the press in like multiple interviews. And these legions of his followers came after me. And it was really kind of terrifying. Like I was on a family vacation and there was all this like just really extraordinary sort of like disruptive minions. And a lot of it was really like, how dare you? Who do you think you are? You couldn't possibly understand this great man and his great ideas. There was a lot of like tweeting from like tech venture capitalists. And it was really, really weird. But one of the things that Christensen became convinced of was that Michael Porter was behind the piece. I had worked for Michael Porter before I even went to graduate school, like decades before. I'm sure that Michael Porter would not remember my name. I was like a temp for his secretary. I wouldn't even work directly for him. I worked for his secretary, but he had like so much business and cash flow to manage that she needed help just dealing with. I basically wrote the checks to pay his visa bills for his second wife. I'd never spoken to him since then. I don't think I ever spoke to him more than once when I worked for him. Michael Porter had nothing to do with the piece. So it was a weird, I would never have anticipated that, but I was just trying to historicize that we were in a different moment, that there is such a thing as a downturn, that innovative technology companies are not always growing up. And when I, right before I worked at the business school and really around at that same time, I went from temp job to temp job working for these companies in Cambridge that were all going under, that they had fired basically all their staff. And just to keep the lights on, have someone, I really just sat in these various companies. A lot of them were software companies and answered the phone while the company went through bankruptcy proceedings. So my sense of like, because it's a huge tech industry, the biotech, the like software companies in Cambridge and in the 80s and 90s. And, they just didn't, you know, most of them did not make it. And they, so like my coming of age around tech was, don't put your money in that. Like, you know, be, you gotta be very careful about these. There's a lot of flyby nights here. And they're not, some of them were the these kind of legacy companies and some of them were newer companies. And then when I went to work at the business school, because I was working for Michael Porter, I read all of his books, like whatever you would just do, like you're working for some guy. Like he really was never in the office because he was traveling all the time giving these lectures. He had like an unbelievably high lecture fee. And I read all the books and I remember like, oh, it's really interesting, but like, how is this guy a guru? Like, how does the world of ideas work over here such that people will pay this guy like $200,000 to enter a room and speak for 15 minutes. Like I was truly baffled by that. So I could see why it would be exciting as a person trying to run a business and trying to figure out how to think about your business. You would like to have some guidance. And the imprimatur of this person is a Harvard Business School professor. And this is, I think some of those early books were Harvard Business Press books. And, you know, excerpted in the Harvard Business Review, and it had this cachet that, or you could go to, you know, they run all these executive management summer classes and people, these guys swan in and like, they have the answers. And I am very sympathetic. Like you're trying to run a company. You're trying to not have to lay people off. You need to show a profit. You want to secure investors. You don't know what the rules are. How do you do this? How can you do it right? How can you stay in business? Like, these are really good questions. I would want answers too. And I could see where Porter had some really empirically interesting answers, but I couldn't see that with Christensen. So I think I just was more like just reflecting on that. And I also like, it was hard to think of how to welcome a reader who's not an adherent of the ideology of disruptive innovation into a long piece about a business theory. So I remember writing about the chattering, the printers, the dot matrix printers being like chatter teeth, just trying to make vivid the obsolescence of machinery that changes a part of technological development, and obsolescence is part of it, and uncertainty is inevitable.
There's also something sort of beautiful about so many of the disruptive companies are run by young people who, though they could not possibly have all the answers, have to pretend as if they do.
Yeah.
And the temp agencies staffed by these young people who are unsure of what to do with their lives, asking questions, falling in and out of love. It's sort of a beautiful evocation of a time of your life,
mm-hmm.
a time of a company's life where you aren't really supposed to be world-eating necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, maybe it's a time for more humility.
Yeah. Hi, Lost Archive listeners. I want to tell you about another podcast to add to your queue, The Jordan Harbinger Show. Jordan's podcast is aimed at making you a better informed critical thinker so you can come to your own conclusions about what's happening in the world. He dives into the minds of fascinating people, from authors and activists to mobsters, spies, and hostage negotiators. You might enjoy Jordan's interview with Yuval Noah Harari, the author of Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, or his recent deep dive into modern flat earth theory, and why some still believe the Earth is flat despite thousands of years of evidence to the contrary. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you'll find something useful you can apply to your own life in every episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show, whether it's asking for advice the right way or discovering a slight mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show, that's H-A-R-B-I-N-G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to podcasts.